So our speaker today is Justin Akers-Chacon. Justin is a socialist activist from the U.S.-Mexico border region, San Diego, California, and he's also a professor of Chicano studies. And he's the author of two excellent books, or a co-author of one of them, No One is Illegal, which is a study of the struggles of immigrant laborers in the United States, and also a second book titled Radicals in the Barrio, which is going to be the subject of another talk Justin is giving later in the conference. Both of those books will be available at the Marxism Conference bookstall. So I'll hand over to Justin now.
Thank you, Julia. I'm a little slow this morning. I didn't see this thing set up over here. Good morning. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation to our comrades and my comrades in Socialist Alternative. So this is a big subject, trying to condense this down to a half hour or so. So I'm going to touch on some broad themes, and hopefully we can have a very rich discussion get through some of the more important aspects of this. I'd like to start my presentation with a picture of two recent victims of the war on immigrants in the U.S. The woman on the right is named Claudia Patricia Gomez. She was assassinated by the Border Patrol about a year ago, trying to cross the border. She was shot. She was hiding in a bush when Border Patrol agents stormed the area where they were crossing. And as she was hiding in a bush, she was shot in the head by a Border Patrol agent who said she had lunged and tried to attack him. The next person just passed away a few months ago. Her name was Jacqueline Cal Maquin. She was a healthy 8-year-old girl who was arrested and put into a detention, held there in extreme cold, in exposure, and over the course of a few days, got really ill and died. Both of these people are from Guatemala, which is in Central America, which is just south of Mexico. And they're two of the people, that have been a part of the recent wave of migration. And they're indigenous people. They are indigenous language speakers. And many of the people who have migrated in the last decade or so are indigenous. This is another picture. Maybe this you have seen this. This is right near, right on the border of U.S. and Mexico. This is about 8 minutes from where I live. And this is a scene of the Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement shooting tear gas into crowds of people, including children, as they were trying to pursue the process of getting asylum into the United States, which is a very legal thing that they have the right to do, but Trump has basically broken international and U.S. law in using force to prevent people from even trying to get into a port of entry where they can apply for asylum. Fortunately, the woman and her two children were able to get into the U.S., but not after being terrorized and traumatized by being shot at. This picture also is interesting because you can't see it, but facing this side, there would be about several hundred activists right on the other side of the border wall, because it's in between two border walls, and we were chanting, "Let them all in, let them all in," and they were chanting back to us in solidarity. So what I'd like to try to do today is I'd like to talk a little bit about the wall and the struggle against detention. And I want to try to go a little bit more deep into understanding the bigger scenario, which is really related to how U.S. capitalism has restructured the region from, of course, the U.S. to Central America through about roughly three decades of free trade agreements, which have been devastating for the working class people of Mexico and Central America. I want to talk about how the region has been militarized through the so-called war on drugs and how this has also contributed to wide-scale violence that has displaced people, including people that you see here. And I want to conclude by talking about how repression of immigrants has intensified who have entered into the country and how this is actually a function of capitalism, which is repression of immigrants to segregate, subjugate, and create the conditions of exploitation that are very profitable, and also dividing the working class. So I want to start by saying, in order to understand the region, we have to understand that there are no borders for capital, and there are no borders for most people. There are borders for workers, and there are borders for refugees. And to illustrate this, between 1994 and 2006, successive U.S. Administrations have extended free trade agreements into Mexico and Central America. And essentially what these have done has forced open their economies and allowed U.S. capital to operate freely in these countries. This was done primarily through debt-induced restructuring. So in other words, Mexico, the governments had borrowed from the U.S. over time, and when they went into economic crisis, the U.S. banks, working in collaboration with the U.S. government, basically said, we'll forgive your debt if you open up your economy and allow U.S. capital to operate freely. And so this was extended first in Mexico and then through Central America. Mexico today is the most open country in the world when it comes to free trade agreements. So these kind of modifications included widespread privatization, the lowering of tariffs, and a variety of other things that basically led to the radical reconstruction of Mexico's economy, and then later Central America. To illustrate the significance of this, you have, for instance, corn tariffs were reduced in Mexico. Mexico is a several thousand year old civilization, and it was founded on the production of corn, one of the primary staples of humanity. By the turn around 2000, Mexico was forced to begin import corn, right, from the U.S. So the lowering of corn tariffs basically meant the U.S. Corn producers could flood Mexican markets. There are hundreds of examples of how Mexico's economy was open, but basically it was done in a way in which there was no protections for Mexican corn farmers or any other group of workers who were suddenly, found their economy open and competing with the U.S. capital. Much of the Mexican economy is owned by the U.S., whether it be manufacturing. So the U.S. has set up manufacturing operations throughout the country called maquiladoras, which are these kind of assembly or production plants. So the border was open so that U.S. capital could go and set up. They could move their aspects of production. So auto industry, for instance, moved aspects of auto parts production to Mexico. Because it's cheaper, because labor is cheaper, right? So there are 6,000 production facilities that produce components for U.S. manufactured goods. Further extending into Central America, much of the clothes produced, the fashionable clothes that are sold in U.S. markets are produced by Central American workers. So U.S. owns about 60% of the manufacturing in Mexico. It owns about 90% of the financial industry. If you've ever heard of a company called Walmart, Walmart is the largest retailer. General Motors is the largest auto manufacturer, and you go down the line. So the border has been widely open for U.S. Corporations, et cetera, to extend its operations. And this has been underpinned by the U.S. government. Creating regional security agreements in which the U.S. has politically supported regimes in Mexico and in Central America that work to keep labor costs low. In other words, labor repression is a feature of this system because In order for U.S. companies to move their production south, they need to be ensured that, that labor costs are kept low. And so in Mexico and in Central America, unions are virtually non-existent. They're existent on paper, but anytime workers try to organize, they face repression. In Central America, and for instance, a lot of the people that you see here are from Honduras, which is in Central America. Honduras has become the most deadly country, one of the most deadly countries in the world, the most deadly country in the Western Hemisphere, with the highest rate of murder per capita. And there's widespread state violence in that country, the disappearance of many activists, labor activists, environmental activists, indigenous activists. Berta Cáceres gained some international notoriety. She was an indigenous rights activist who was assassinated by several military figures a few years ago. So this has been underwritten by U.S. security agreements embodied in something called Plan Mérida. Starting under George Bush in 2005 and then continuing to the Obama administration and through Trump, the U.S. has supplied military equipment in the amount of billions of dollars to Mexico and also to Central America. And theoretically, this is to fight the war on drugs because of the cartels, the drug cartels that operate throughout the region. In reality, much of the infrastructure of much of the military hardware and much of the funding has gone into, well, part of it has been siphoned off in corruption, but the other part has been used in many ways to suppress social movements in Mexico. For instance, in 2014, the government of Mexico disappeared 43 students in the state of Guerrero, which is where there's a lot of violence. And the 43 students were disappeared in collaboration with the government or the mayor of the city of Iguala, and in collaboration with the police. And the 43 students were disappeared. They were protesting public education cuts. So there's a lot of violence associated with how weapons and how military allocations have been used against the people. And then this is, of course, fueled by the fact that drug consumption in the U.S. is the largest per capita in the world. And so the U.S., as a side note, the U.S., at the turn of the millennium, began to implement various strategies to close off the drug corridor, which used to go from South America to Florida through Miami, closing that off and pushing it through Central America and Mexico, which is one of the major factors that fueled the rise of cartels who moved the drugs from South America to Mexico. So I'll give you some statistics on the level of violence, because the people are fleeing violence as well. From 2005 to 2013, the number of violent deaths, primarily disproportionately of women in Central America, rose by 263%. The murder rate has tripled from 35 per 100,000 in 2005 to 91 per 100,000 in 2011. In Mexico, over 100,000 people have been killed since 2006. 40,000 people in Mexico are disappeared. These are some of the statistics. One other thing I wanted to share with you is this picture. Maybe you recognize this figure on the left. She's somewhat well-known in U.S. politics. This is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State during the Obama administration, and under her watch, the U.S. supported a coup, the overthrow of the democratically elected Honduran government in 2009. A president by the name of Manuel Zelaya was basically arrested and deported out of the country by the military, and this was overseen by Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration. Part of the reason why the U.S. wanted to have a coup was because the democratically elected presidency of Manuel Zelaya rose up on the wave of popular discontent in that country, opposing the free trade agreements, opposing the drug war, with an intention to double the minimum wage. So a number of factors that were out of line with what the U.S. Government was willing to tolerate. And so this is a picture of Hillary Clinton shaking hands with a person who came to power illegitimately after the overthrow of that government. And here she is shaking his hand in a very pleased way, proud of her work. So a lot of profit has flown north through these arrangements in various ways. I'll give you a statistic here to show you how profitable it's been for the U.S. From 1993 to 2015, the U.S.'s real per capita gross domestic product grew 39.3%, reflecting the significant transfer of wealth from Central America and Mexico. The overwhelming majority of this wealth went to the top 1%, the famous 1% in the U.S. that we talk about a lot. And these arrangements have not only transformed in a destructive way the lives of working class people, but they've also, but wealth is also transferred in the form of the debt, paying back of debt. So, by 2019, total debt to the U.S. had risen to close to $2.4 trillion. So not only are they facing these kinds of circumstances that I've already talked about, but governments, Mexico and Central American governments have to pay back a significant amount of their total income, national income, to service the debts that are held in place. So when more surplus value is extracted from labor than is necessary to reproduce it, you know, the ability to feed, clothe, house, and sustain themselves, family stability breaks down. Again, going back to the pictures of the migrants. Oh, I forgot to show this picture. This is a picture of the U.S. Border Patrol as part of a military agreement embodied in Plan Merida. This is them training Honduran police and military officials. So this is a U.S. military agent. The Honduran police and military have some of the highest rates of human rights violations in the world. So this has contributed to the breakdown of the ability of many people to sustain themselves and their families, leading to the crisis of migration. Following the wealth leaving their respective countries, Mexican, Guatemalan, Salvadorian, and Honduran workers especially have migrated to the United States in the last few decades. So to give you a sense of this, there are currently about 13 million Mexican nationals living in the United States, many of whom are a significant portion of who are undocumented. There are about 3.4 million Central Americans who have left Central America. These are relatively small countries. So, for instance, El Salvador has 10 million people. So you get a sense of the scale of the number of people who have been forced to flee. So we see a circumstance, and let me show you that. This is a picture of a maquiladora. So there are several thousand maquiladoras in Mexico, again, U.S. owned. There are hundreds more in Central America. So the way that the economy has been restructured is that many people have been displaced. Segments of those populations have been displaced and concentrated in cities to work in these factories. So U.S. capital not only displaces, it exploits. The border wall is crucial for this arrangement to ensure that, to discourage, you know, full migration to exploit people in their own homelands, right? And then the border wall serves to then further criminalize immigrants once they cross the border. So the U.S. ruling class has increasingly criminalized immigration, and we've seen the growth of a vast repressive state apparatus to hunt, detain, deport, police, and kill non-citizens. Immigrant repression has since become a consensus in the two capitalist parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. It has become a very profitable enterprise for some sections of capital, which I'll talk about in a minute, such as detention, which is a huge booming industry. Defense, much of the U.S. has a massive defense apparatus. Many private defense companies have retooled much of their production towards border enforcement technologies. Information tech, Google, Amazon, Microsoft have invested significant investments in artificial intelligence and cloud storage so that they could sell to the government, to factor in, to immigration, sell to DHS and to serve the apparatus with information technology, et cetera. And then, of course, there's other sections of capital that profit off this as well. Those who employ workers such as in agriculture, manufacturing, food processing, et cetera. And so repression has served to segregate and partition workers, hold down wages, and make it easier to break unions. And I'll point out that, let's see if I can find the picture. The walling off of the U.S.-Mexico border really began in earnest in 1994 under Democrat Bill Clinton. This was referred to as the Operation Gatekeeper. So the same year that free trade agreements were implemented, right? Instead of saying, "Well, we anticipate that there could be changes in immigration as a result of these radical restructuring programs," the U.S. The U.S. government said, "Well, we're going to build a wall." Operation Gatekeeper was designed to not stop migration, but to prevent it from crossing in traditional crossing points. So the walls were built in cities. Because along the U.S.-Mexican border, you have, there's such a level of integration that you have cities that are connected, about a dozen or so cities that line the border. And so what they did was they put the wall and the enforcement apparatus in the cities, and it has pushed migration out into deadly terrain. So this picture shows just one little piece of the border area. California is over here. This is Arizona, and then New Mexico. The area where you see the red dots is a vast desert, and so this is not walled off. And so the channeling of immigration through the desert led to significant number of deaths. Since 1994, over 8,600 bodies have been found of all ages, usually younger people. A lot of people who have difficulty, the least physically capable of surviving. And typically, it's the poorer migrants because the border wall also produced a smuggling industry in which people can afford it. Through points of entry in the back of trucks and buying off U.S. customs agents, etc. So there's kind of a subclass system to the deaths, right? Which is the poorest people tend to be those who cross without support and end up paying the price. Once in the country, we see there is a further expansion of immigration enforcement. Beginning with the Bush administration, which began in 2000, from 2000 to 2008, we see the creation and arming of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is an interior police. So we have the Border Patrol, 20,000 agents that work within 100 miles of the border. And then we have the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is an interior police force. And the operation of ICE is really one that has become one in which there's very little oversight and very unchecked, in which about over 20,000 interior agents in ICE operate with virtual impunity. Their charge is to arrest those who have been to find and arrest those who have been given removal orders, and that typically means people who have entered into the system. Either they lost a hearing when they tried to get permanent residence, or they were caught up in some kind of raid or something like that, and their name is now in the system as somebody who is not legally authorized, and it could range to people who've committed crimes. But the overwhelming majority of people who are caught by ICE are not criminal offenders. They're what are called non-criminal immigration offenders, people who basically who are known to be undocumented. And so under Bush and Obama, the 2000 to 2016, about over 5 to 6 million people have been deported, primarily through the operations of ICE. It's interesting to point out, too, that ICE has expanded so much, not only within the border, but it's actually operating now in 70 countries. So when we hear that Remy Kanasi was denied entrance, part of that has to do with ICE agents work alongside Australian immigration agents and collaborate. And so not only was Remy Kanasi denied entrance here, but almost simultaneously another Palestinian rights activist, Omar Barghouti, was denied entrance into the United States. So they've taken their actions internationally. So Trumpism. One more thing to point out about this picture is that much of the enforcement apparatus within the interior has been used to target the working class. So immigrants make up about a fourth of the working class. Undocumented people are the most gainfully employed segment of our population, right? Which is logical if you think about it, because if somebody's going to cross the border, they've been displaced, they're gonna work. And so there's a lot of people come to work, they send money back to their families, they sustain themselves. We've seen an increase in the repression turning to the point of production, where ICE agents will conduct raids, they'll target immigrants in the workplace. And this has become more notoriously used in those workplaces where immigrants are part of union organizing drives. Consequently, immigrants are much more likely to organize or join a union than a U.S. citizen is. They tend to have the proclivity to do so. And because there has been an immigrant rights movement in the country, we have seen that much of the targeting has moved to the workplace. And so that shows that the U.S. ruling class understands the role that immigrants can play in at this crucial time of rebuilding a labor movement, joining unions, and this is part of what they want to prevent from happening. So the Trump administration also has increased the targeting of immigrant rights activists themselves. There have been over 20 high-profile direct targeting of undocumented activists, the people who are organizing within their own communities. here's a picture of a comrade, somebody who, a socialist organizer in Los Angeles, who's an undocumented rights activist, who was singled out and targeted for deportation. So when Trump came to office, he basically represents a vile and disgusting continuation of the same policies and an intensification. The first thing he did was he declared that he would ban Muslims from entering the country, purposefully using racist and Islamophobic language to motivate his executive order. He also, promoted the idea that he would expand the wall, that he would give more freedom to the immigration agents to operate with even less impunity, which they virtually already have very little, and other things. He also targeted people who were previously protected. So there are certain categories of undocumented people who have, under previous administrations like Obama, they have been afforded special protections, like youth. There are 750,000 undocumented youth who came over, sometimes 3 days after they were born, right? Who have lived most of their life in the U.S. and they were given special reprieve from deportation, and they were given rights to work. They were referred to as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. He stripped them of their protections. There was another million people who the courts determined are not a threat, that they are undocumented, but they have not committed any crimes, and that they are not, that they fit within a category of people who also deserve reprieve. He stripped out of it. So basically, he's just tremendously exacerbated, the attacks, even on the most vulnerable. Furthermore, his racist and Islamophobic and violent rhetoric has encouraged racists and violent and Islamophobic people to take action. We've seen a significant increase in hate crimes since Trump came to office. Last year alone, there was an increase of over 17%, over 7,000 hate crimes in the United States. Keep in mind, only a minority of those are actually reported and documented. And as probably some of you probably have heard or seen images of, he created a policy last year in which all people crossing the border, all families would be separated, children would be placed in children, kind of transitional homes, and the parents would be arrested pending pending a review of whether or not they are a criminal threat. And this has led to the disgusting separation of families that in which over 15,000 children in the last 2 years have been separated from their parents, and many of them move through the system, in some cases being placed with foster parents. In some cases, being housed in these large facilities. Consequently, much of these are privately run facilities that the ICE contracts out, and there's very little oversight. There's very little vetting of personnel to care for the children. There have been over 30,000 documented cases of abuse, over 3,000 documented cases of sexual violence and abuse of children. All of this in the last few years under these conditions. So there's been a significant degradation, and so it plays out in these kind of conditions. The most recent example, I thought I had a picture of it, but there's an image that was circulating in which so many people, there's so little housing for the immigrants who are detained that they started placing them in freeway underpasses. They would gate off freeway underpasses in El Paso, Texas, just shove them under freeway overpasses. Here's a picture of a child exposed in one of these open-air holding centers laying on rocks, right, to give you a sense of the barbarism that has come to characterize our immigration system. And then I'm moving towards my conclusion here, which is the movement against walls and Trumpism here. But I also want to point out that the detentions industry in the U.S. has grown dramatically. There are two private corporations, one called Geo Group and one called CoreCivic. They change their names every few years after they get exposed for the depth of corruption. But their since the increase in detention over the last few years, their stock has increased. They're highly profitable. So of the 51,000 beds in detention centers that exist there's over 600 of them across the country, 70% of them are for-profit industries in which the ICE basically pays these corporations. And in many of these detention centers, they don't hire staff, they use the detainees themselves to perform the labor functions inside the detention centers. There's been a number of people who've gone undercover, undocumented people have risked their themselves to investigate by getting arrested into these detention centers, who have documented in some cases they don't pay anything, in some cases they pay the workers $1 a day to perform all the functions. So it's really just an egregious profit making enterprise. So there is a movement. There have been movements that have developed over the last few years that have represent a qualitative turn in opposition to the border wall and the detention system and the way ICE, what ICE has become. I'll give you a few examples. When Trump implemented the executive order in which the travel ban was going to be conducted, excluding people from 7 predominantly Muslim countries, it happened over a period of time in which over 100 people came in from those countries and were immediately detained in airports across the country. In response to this, thousands of people spontaneously went to the airports. And I know in San Diego, we had about 1,000 people go to the airports. In New York City, they had several thousand people. And in some cases, these airports, there were so many people that they essentially kind of blocked off the airports and parts of the airport shut down, and they just rallied all night saying, let them go. So this was a very promising thing for those of us who were still coming to terms with the election of Trump. It showed that resistance could be built, and a federal judge responded to the movement by overturning the executive order, although a right-wing packed Supreme Court later overturned the overturning. We've seen, in response to the zero-tolerance policy of separating families, we've seen the organization of protests across the country in 2018 of June. Hundreds of thousands of people marched against family separation. Smaller groups within that those large rallies began to occupy ICE detention centers, which is something we had not seen up to that point. They began to try to block off the ICE detention centers because what would happen would be that, for instance, the children would be brought to these centers and then they would be sent off. And many of these children, over 2,000, have not been returned to their families. They're lost in the system. I mean, it's really a nightmare. And so the Occupy ICE activists basically tried to disrupt that. And it was successful in some cities where they shut down anywhere from 1 day to 2 weeks, this process of moving people through these centers. And ultimately, the level of outrage led, produced another response from a federal judge who overturned the separation policy. In the last election cycle, the abolished, what has now come to be known as the abolished ICE movement, which is a pretty radical demand that has now become somewhat mainstream, saying the ICE itself should be gotten rid of, we should abolish ICE, it actually entered into the political cycle the last November 2018. We saw the election of Democratic Socialists, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and others who campaigned on abolish ICE as part of their platform. A Democratic Party candidate for governor in New York City named Cynthia Nixon, who lost, running against the Democratic Party machine in the state, actually went on a speaking tour in which she called for the abolition of ICE and referred to it as a terrorist organization. There were even 19 ICE investigators who wrote an open letter saying that their work is being hampered by the fact that the ICE institution itself is operating in such a barbaric way, and called for a scaling back of the repression. And this spread in many different ways throughout the system. Workers at Amazon and Microsoft actually wrote an open letter to their CEO saying, we don't want to cooperate with ICE. So it played out in all kinds of different ways. I mentioned it in the opening night speech, another major sort of victory, and I'll conclude with this, was the fact that Bush, they all blend together now, Trump, has forcefully demanded that he get, billions of dollars to continue to expand the 600-mile border wall. He wants to see it built across the border. And the culmination of the movements that we've seen have really impacted public opinion. And popular opinion is against it and against Trump. So that played out in Congress, even within his own party, the majority of Democrats and Republicans opposing further funding for the wall. And so in response, he said, if you don't, in Trump style, right, if you don't give me the money I want, I'm going to shut down the government. And so he did. And for about 2 months, nearly 2 months, sections of the federal government were not operational, and the Democrats did very little, except to say, we'll give you half of that, we agree with you that we need to have more security, but more cameras and more agents. Not all, so this is the level of opposition, that the Democrats presented. Ultimately, the 600,000 workers who were not getting paid included airport workers, such as air traffic controllers and others. And after 2 months, many began to call in sick. Many began to do no-shows. So there was kind of like scattered resistance in which workers stopped showing up. And ultimately, the flight attendants union, Sarah Nelson, who had already kind of become prominent criticizing Trump's policies, had announced that if Trump doesn't pay the workers because of the deteriorating conditions on the job and the fact that airport security, air safety couldn't be guaranteed anymore, that if Trump didn't sign the budget without the border wall, funding that that they were going to carry out a strike across the country, effectively shutting down the airlines. And after after nearly 2 months of not moving, within several hours, Trump buckled and signed the budget. So these are some signs of the resistance that we've seen in the U.S. And very lastly, we've seen a strike wave across the maquiladoras in Mexico. Workers in over 50 of these U.S.-owned factories shut down in the matter of about a month, shut down on strike, taking on the most powerful U.S. corporations, because these maquiladoras are subsidiaries of the major auto industry, for instance, and shutting them down and winning. And they won not only by organizing themselves, but they actually had to organize against their own fake union leadership, which stays in place to keep workers from organizing, and against, you know, the U.S. companies themselves. They won also because they threatened to shut down the whole auto industry in North America because they produce crucial components. So in conclusion, there are, you know, I wanted to touch on some of these themes. You know, and I'll point out that there are 288 free trade agreements recorded by the World Trade Organization. Only 40 contain provisions that allow for some form of labor migration. And this is typically for those with specialized professions. Most working class people don't have a means to migrate, whereas everybody else does. So we don't have open borders for working class people. We have open borders for capital. Concerted efforts by activists to confront and oppose the most repressive features of immigrant repression and border violence have stifled, but have not stopped the racist crusade of Trump, because it's not Trump, it's a system. It's the system of capitalism as it has developed under these conditions. As immigrant workers, airport workers, maquiladora workers across the border demonstrate, it will take coordinated actions of workers to leverage their collective power to shut down production and shut down the capitalist economy, and ultimately fight to get rid of capitalism altogether, replace it with socialism. That will be what will be necessary in order to defeat the barbarism and violence of border walls and immigration restrictions once and